Live from the mist-enshrouded mountaintop fortress that is X and Y Communications headquarters, you're listening to the world-famous Mountaintop Podcast. And now, here's your host, Scott McKay.
How's it going, gentlemen? Welcome once again to another episode of the world-famous Mountaintop Podcast. My name is Scott McKay, at Scott McKay on Twitter, Real Scott McKay on Instagram, Scott McKay on YouTube. You can find us on the web at www.mountaintoppodcast.com, and please do go and join our thriving community on Facebook. The Facebook group is Mountaintop Summit. With me today is a guest I'm really excited to have on the show. He is an internationally famous author, a neuroscientist, and a research fellow at the Harvard University School of Education. Amongst his books are Dark Horse, which is one of his newer books, which we'd love to have him back on to discuss sometime soon. And the focus of our conversation today, his famous book, A Billion Wicked Thoughts. So without any further ado, I'd like to welcome Ogi Ogus to the show. Ogi, welcome, man.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, man. We're excited to have you too, because every once in a while, there's a book written with subject matter involved, with a main topic that's so exciting and so interesting that it's just a no-brainer to have the author on this show. And this is one of those situations. Your book is called A Billion Wicked Thoughts. And we were discussing this a little bit before we hit the record button on this podcast. It kind of reminded me of the premise of Nancy Friday's book back in the early 70s, My Secret Garden, where she collected the anonymous fantasies from women all over the world and published them. And they were just depraved, dirty, horny thoughts. And it shocked the world when that book, you know, kind of hit the bookstores.
That's right. That was a precursor. We actually looked at that when we were doing our research ourselves. That was a very early attempt at looking at women's sexual fantasies and sexual interests, which had always been a very under-researched area. For a long time, most of the research in the sex sciences was on male interests, probably because most sex scientists were male. But Nancy Friday was a pioneer, but obviously what we did in our book went way, way further than that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would have loved to have had Nancy Friday as a guest on this show also. But I talked to her publicist and the guy was like, you know, I'm sure she would have loved to have been on your show. But, you know, she won't even do the Today Show nowadays. So I think you understand why she won't do yours either. I'm like, yeah, crystal clear. I had no idea she was that old a lady. But that book was written a long time ago.
Yeah.
And you're right. You know, until relatively recently, shockingly recently, actually, Ogi, really all we had was the Kinsey Institute to tell us anything about people's human sexual patterns. So books like yours, I think, are really fascinating. And just to kind of lay this out for the guys here, no pun intended, A Billion Wicked Thoughts harnesses the power of the anonymity of the internet and literally a billion different internet searches on sexual subjects. And you have compiled those patterns and tried to make sense of them. That's pretty much how it's summed up, right?
That's right. We actually try to get our hands on any possible online data set about people's sexual behavior. So certainly one of the biggest data sets we got were searches. We have different collections of search histories. The most detailed one is from America Online, actually. America Online kind of notoriously shared a lot of their customers' search histories. Now, they tried to anonymize it. They took out people's names and that sort of thing. But oftentimes, if you can see, you know, what a person searched for over many months, there's enough clues about who that person is, even if they don't actually include their actual name, because you can tell where they live and maybe the school their kid goes to and things like that. So it ended up being a publicity nightmare for AOL, but it also prevented anybody else from ever sharing search histories too. So when we did our research, we got lucky because we were in this really wonderful window of time on the internet, which is when the internet was developed enough to have a lot of online sexual searches, but before all the privacy fears had really kicked in and everybody started clamping down on data. So there was there'd be no way to do what we did today, because it's much, much harder to get your hands on data. When we did our research, it was at this tipping point. In the early days of the internet, for maybe the first 10 to 15 years, the primary business model for online porn, for online sexual content, was a subscription model. You know, you go to a website that might specialize in, I don't know, teenage Asian women who like to sail. And you pay, you know, $30 a month and you get new material, you know, frequently on that particular subject. So when we did our research, those were still around and it was possible to gather data from sites like that. But the tube sites had just started gathering steam. And tube sites, of course, today, the whole erotic landscape online is almost all a few multinational corporations with their tube sites like YouPorn, PornTube, RedTube, Xvideos, XNXX. So those tube sites, which are modeled after YouTube, of course, those had just started coming online when we did our research. And a lot of those sites were willing to share their data with us. So Pornhub, for example, gave us a lot of their internal data back then. So we had the tube site data, plus we had data on all these old subscription sites. We managed to get a whole lot of individual search histories and search histories. But we also, much like Nancy Friday did, we also analyzed erotic stories. So we got hold of more than a million different erotic stories and more than a million different fan fiction stories, which is a special kind of, can't really call it erotica. A lot of it's erotica, not all of it's erotica, but it's almost entirely written by women for women. So we also did a lot of analysis on these erotic stories as well. So basically, we just gathered up every possible source of information about people's sexual behavior online. And we did it during this time when we could get the data and people weren't closing their doors on us yet. And the result is we got the richest, most detailed look at people's true sexual interests that had ever been done. And it was completely different than what most scientists expected. We pretty much overturned just about all of the conventional wisdom about what men and women truly liked. It definitely was a landmark book that's changed the whole field of sex research.
Yeah, and that's why we're all here, to hear some of the juicy stuff that you uncovered. You know, one more thought on Nancy Friday that just occurred to me while you were talking about the erotic stories. You're a Maryland boy.
Like yes. Me.
The very yes. first fantasy in the book is she's at a football game, and it's a Baltimore Colts game at Memorial Stadium. And a touchdown is scored. And the whole crowd goes nuts. So, you know, nobody notices that an anonymous fan basically takes her from behind and reams her while the game, you know, the crowd's going nuts over something they're completely distracted by. And so she gets to scream and enjoy the sex and the orgasm. And it's all basically happening in a crowd of 50,000 people and nobody's noticing it. So it's like public sex yet private at the same time. And that was this particular woman's horniest fantasy. So, I mean, even right out of the gate in that book, it's like, wow, you got to be kidding me. This is what really goes through women's heads, right?
And that's a very common fantasy. Certainly, when you look online, that's a woman's fantasy of being taken, dominated, even non-consensually, is extremely common. And of course, it's super controversial and super uncomfortable for women too. In fact, probably your listeners don't know this, but romance novels, we looked at the numbers and probably just as many women consume romance novels as men consume online porn. The numbers are very close. So romance novels used to primarily feature heroes that were rapists. The most popular romance novels of the 70s and then the 80s and even into a little bit in the early 90s, you'd have the hero, the romantic hero, often would rape the heroine in a non-consensual way early in the story. And then eventually she forgives him and they fall in love by the end of the story. And then in the 90s, as women's rights movement and feminism became stronger within the culture, there was a great reckoning among writers of romance literature about what to do about this. Because even though this was clearly a fantasy, the idea of writing entire novels about this no longer seemed acceptable. So these days, you'll no longer find outright rape, and you certainly won't find the heroes raping the heroines in romance novels. But one way that authors have gotten around this, I guess you could say, informal taboo, is they found clever and creative literary ways to kind of have a rape scene without it being a rape scene. And one of the most successful examples of this is paranormal romance, such as the Twilight series of novels, which is aimed at younger readers. But what you have there is you have vampires. And so you'll have a male vampire that will seduce and then, you know, maybe even suck the blood of the heroine. And the way those scenes are written, it's very much like written like an erotic non-consensual scene, except instead of it being sex, it's a vampire you know, penetrating her neck, you know, sucking her blood, you know, she can't escape. It's a different way of having the Johnny Unitas story, except in more modern, acceptable garb.
I'm sure the New York Giants thought Johnny Unitas was a bloodsucker, but, you know, the New York fans. Yeah. You know, it's funny, though, even when women watch female-oriented cable channels like Oxygen and Lifetime, there are so many drama shows with rape scenes in them.
Yeah.
And I remember just happening across the television one time where my wife was watching a show and going, why do women want to watch this? And she's like, I know, right? But it's like every show has a woman getting raped, or it's about a woman who's been raped. And what's going on there with women? I mean, obviously they don't want to be raped in real life, but they love this fantasy of a guy taking them. Is it that the actual act itself is exciting and hot, but, you know, they kind of want it to happen in a way that's not dangerous to them?
There's all kinds of sexual paradoxes that are wired into our brain, and both men and women. It's very easy to find many different things that we're just designed to find arousing, but at the same time, maybe our wise, world-weary brain says, you know, that's not a good idea. Certainly, there's probably no better example of that than the domination fantasy. So women, for certain, are aroused by the idea of dominant men. And maybe the bad boys who don't play by the rules and even go so far as to aggressively take a woman. Women are aroused by the idea of alpha males demonstrating their power and their passion. I mean, passion's a big part of that fantasy too. It's not just the power. It's that the man is so overwhelmed with the attractiveness of the woman that he just can't control himself. So that's rolled into that fantasy too. In fact, I'd say the one sexual interest that we all have in common, men and women, gay and straight, that's a common thread across all forms of erotica. In general, men and women's sexual tastes are completely different, and what turns women on doesn't turn men on. But the one place we all come together is on fantasies of domination and submission. Everyone is aroused to some extent by either a fantasy of being dominated or a fantasy of being the dominator. Obviously, most men have fantasies of domination, but there's certainly many men who are more aroused by being dominated, being submissive like a woman, and vice versa. Most women have fantasies of being dominated, but there's certainly a minority of women who, you know, are aroused by being dominated. This is something that's deeply wired into our sexual brain. It's something we share with all animals too, because in the sexual act, there has to be, you know, a male role and a female role, a dominant role and a submissive role. And so this is so deep in our minds. But at the same time, obviously, women do not want to be raped. Women do not want to have non-consensual sex. They do not want to be dominated. So this leads to a great deal of discomfort, controversy, discussion. And this is why rape is such a huge topic, because it's not a simple thing. Oftentimes it's presented politically as a simple thing, but it is all wrapped up in our sexual natures. It's very difficult to disentangle all this. I can give an example on the male side. The evidence overwhelmingly shows that men are designed to get jealous and outraged at the thought of their partner cheating on them. But male sexual brains are also designed to get aroused by the idea of their partner having sex with other men. It's something we share with other primates. So a lot of men do have fantasies about their girlfriends or wives sleeping with other men. There's whole swinger communities that cater to that. And cuckold porn is one of the most popular kinds of porn that features this fantasy as well. But that's an example on the male side. Of course, most men truly don't want their wife or their girlfriend to cheat on them. But it's also true that there's some part of them in many men that can be aroused by that too. So when it comes to our sexual taste, there's all kinds of things that make us uncomfortable or paradoxical, controversial, that, yeah, we just don't have an easy time of it when it comes to our sexual interest.
Yeah, an interesting thing about porn is it allows you to fantasize in ways that you would never act out in real life, nor want to. Therefore, all these different kinds of porn that are so popular that many people find shocking when they find out it's so popular, yet, you know, clearly this is what's going on in a lot of people's minds. You get a lot of the gangbang porn. You get a lot of male stripper porn where the male strippers are just being sucked off by 100 women.
Yeah.
You know, here's my wife. Here's my, you know, stepsister. Here's my stepmother. All these different situations where it sounds really horny on paper, but in real life would be so fraught that there's no way in hell we would ever even think about it. Like, for most guys, it sounds really great to go to an orgy where you have 26 women servicing you at once. But in real life, you're going to think to yourself, wait a minute, where have all these women been? What kind of diseases am I going to get from this experience? What if I make one of these women pregnant? How am I going to perform sexually for 26 women? You know, and here's the thing that often comes up when you read interviews about inside the porn industry. Most men flat out can't get it up in public when other people are watching and, you know, a porn actress is laying there and they're like, okay, do this and do that to her. Most men just get stage fright. So all of these different situations conspire to keep us from living out these fantasies in real life. But when it's just us and our, you know, computer and nobody else is around, man, we have no problem getting horny to all that stuff, right?
I was going to say, when you were talking about the orgy fantasy, we found out from our research from talking to people that the truth is a lot of men, when they get into an orgy situation, when they're, even though they're surrounded by attractive women who they're able to have sex with, they do have trouble getting it up because, you know, they're suddenly aware that there's all these strangers, you know, looking at them. You know, it's one thing that if you have a girl you've just taken home for a one night stand, you've probably developed some sort of chemistry before that happens. But if you just walk into a room with a bunch of strangers, it doesn't matter how attractive they are. You know, they're suddenly, you know, if you haven't built up some kind of rapport ahead of time, it's difficult for a lot of men to get it up in those circumstances. But again, this is just like you said, this points to the fact that a lot of the fantasies that we have are really that fantasies. They really aren't, you know, they wouldn't work if we acted them out in real life. Another big one is incest. There's a lot of incest porn, erotic stories about incest. Certainly a lot of videos that they're pretending to be, you know, mothers and sons or daughters and fathers as part of the fantasy. Another popular one, but, you know, in real life, even if you try to pursue it, you know, I think for most people, they'd have trouble enjoying it. And as you said, it would be so fraught. So after doing our research, my co-investigator and I definitely believe that having all of this erotic material online is actually a good thing. Because it does allow us to explore these sexual interests, these sexual fantasies that we have in a safe place. And therefore, we don't need to go act out on it in the real world.
You know, porn itself is a very controversial subject, the very existence of it. What's your view on porn? What are the pros and cons of viewing porn?
Well, back in the 1960s is when a organized anti-porn movement first began. And back then, of course, the only way you could see pornography was to go to the red light district in a city, you know, or maybe go to some private, one of these private black market stores where you can trade like 8mm films and things like that. So it was very, very hard to get your hands on porn, or you'd watch stag films and, you know, another kind of 8mm film with your buddies. But these are, you know, by today's standards, extremely inconvenient. But when that was the way men accessed porn, there was a movement saying that porn tended to cause men to want to perform sexual assault and acts of sexual violence against women. So that argument began back in the 60s. And each decade, as the technology for distributing porn got more and more sophisticated and more democratic, so it became cheaper and easier, of course, with the videos, then you could just go to the back room at your video store and pull out some porn and take that home. And then, of course, now on the internet, it's available 24 hours a day for free, easily in the privacy of your own home. So in the 60s, they said, if these porn opponents said, if we keep making porn more available, rape's going to go through the roof. But in fact, what we've actually seen is the exact opposite. The more porn society has, the more sexual assault and the more rape goes down. This has happened in every civilized, in every first world country that's made it easier to get their hands on porn, including here in America. So by the same arguments that the anti-porn people have been making for decades now, we should be living in a society where there's, you know, open rapes on the street, you know, on a daily basis, you know, since every man in society now has unlimited access to this stuff. But what we see is that it gives people an outlet. If you can get exactly what you need online and have that sexual satisfaction, you go and masturbate and, you know, you're satisfied and then you move on with your life. That's how most men have adapted to this availability of porn. There's certainly other concerns and downsides to having lots of access to porn. Having young people exposed to porn is another uncertain and troubling area. The research on that is still unclear, but it definitely seems plausible that exposing young people to a wide variety of hardcore porn at a very early age, that may have long-term detrimental effects in terms of being able to have healthy relationships with the opposite sex. But in terms of having adult access to pornography, I just think it's a good thing, and it shouldn't be restricted for adults at any rate.
Yeah, that whole argument of porn causes more rape is kind of like video games cause more violence.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Or rock and roll music causes more violence, or this, that, and the other. And it's just frustratingly for the people who are trying to make that point, never seeming to be borne out in real life. And that's always kind of an ongoing conversation between both sides, for sure.
There's an interesting coda to that, too. So even today, there's a number of activist groups that are trying to make porn more positive and less misogynistic. And these are usually women's groups, and they create websites, or they oftentimes even create erotica itself, which has the people depicted in the erotic scenes. They respect each other. They have relationships. They have conversation, before they have the sex, and then they have respectful sex. And they've been trying to push this. The fact of the matter is, we looked into this in our research. Women consumers, when they have a choice to look at porn, they never choose that stuff. So they never choose the sex positive stuff. They'll go look at the same erotic fantasies, the stories, in some cases, the videos that have hardcore porn, semi-non-consensual, semi-exploitative. That's what women's fantasies are. So even among women who are very conscious of this paradox, when women have the freedom to choose the erotica, won't they choose the somewhat misogynistic, somewhat not politically correct porn over politically correct porn when they have the opportunity? So the fact is, we like what we like. We can't legislate. We can't talk people out of changing their likes. I mean, any more than you can talk a gay person into becoming a straight person. You can't talk a guy that's aroused by watching gangbang porn to not be aroused by gangbang porn. But at the same time, we can say, you know what? Go watch as much gangbang porn as you want. But if you go out into the world and try to gangbang a woman against her will, that's a crime. Like, it seems pretty easy to make the distinction between reality and fantasy, but we all have a fear that other people, not us, are going to have trouble with that distinction. But the numbers, the data just overwhelmingly shows, give people access to the erotica they want, and they're much less likely to act out on it in the real world.
Yeah, that reminds me of an old Onion article where the headline was something to the effect of 95% of people in urban environments believe that more people should take mass transit to work as long as it's someone else other than them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I mean, I have suspected for quite a long time that the so-called female-friendly porn was serving a more political purpose than a prurient one.
Yeah. It doesn't have an actual audience. I would hasten to add that I wouldn't want any of your listeners to think that women secretly want you to go up to them and non-consensually take them from behind. So, like, if you're at a Colts game today and your quarterback scores a touchdown, don't start groping the woman in front of you. Women do not want that in the real world. It's a fantasy. It's in the bedroom with somebody they care about. They're going to act it out. But please don't think for a moment that secretly women really do want you to go and abuse them, because that is not the case at all. We all can make the distinction between what's in our fantasy and what we want in the real life.
Well, I appreciate that disclaimer genuinely. However, I think it harkens back to what you were saying just a couple minutes ago, that deep down, people can think for themselves. I mean, this is something right now that both political parties in this country, the great United States of America, haven't seemed to figure out. They're thinking they can say outrageous things and everybody will just follow along hook, line, and sinker. But in the voting booth, in the privacy of our own room with our porn in front of us, I think, people pretty much make their own decisions, and they're reasonable, and, they're not stupid or crazy. So yeah, I'm with you 100%. I think people can fantasize about all sorts of depraved, horny, like the title of your book suggests, a billion wicked thoughts. And then in real life, understand what's going to get us arrested and understand, the parameters of real life versus fantasy life, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, to go back to what you were saying about the female friendly porn and how women, once they get online, they don't watch any of that stuff anyway. They're going and watching other things. People really do have varied interests in what turns them on, and it's not necessarily uniform even within themselves from day to day what they're going to watch. I mean, one day a person may wake up and feel in the mood for this. The next day they may wake up and be in the mood for that. And so you have rise to all different kinds of porn, even the situational relationshipy porn, even what's commonly known as the girlfriend experience porn, which, you know, you're welcome to describe a little bit more if you want. Sometimes that's exactly what a man or a woman will be horny for, is something that does resemble real life. And one of the things that I suspect is probably driving that is the person who's the subject in the porn movie reminds them of someone they actually know in real life, and therefore that drives a fantasy that, you know, could be fueled a little bit by something that's going on in their real life. You know what I mean? So, I mean, it could be just about anything. It's not necessarily that we're always diving down into the depths and wanting to watch a woman's mascara run, et cetera, et cetera. Right. Sometimes we have a much more, dare I say, wholesome view of what's going to turn us on in the moment. But it still can have some complications that are driving what and why we're watching what we're watching, right?
That's right. I wanted to add on to that to say women have much greater variety in their taste, talking about, you know, different interests and from day to day. Women are much more volatile in terms of what turns them on, and even across a lifetime. So what a woman is aroused by when she's in her 20s may not be the same thing that she's aroused by in her 30s or her 40s, but quite different for men. Men's sexual interests tend to get baked in at a very early age and don't tend to change much. So men seem to have a much smaller range of interests, you know, things that really excite them. You know, some men's just one or two things, you know, others it's a handful, but that usually doesn't change too much over the lifespan. As you pointed out, you know, sometimes men want the dirtiest fantasies to be fulfilled, and other times it's, you know, much more like a girlfriend experience type fantasy. But if a man's interested in, say, feet when he's 17 years old, almost certainly when he's 87 years old, he's still going to be interested in feet. That's not the kind of thing that changes.
Yes, interesting. And you're talking about women in particular having this wide range of potential sexual interests. It seems to me that if you show me a woman who's angry about porn and thinks all porn should be ended and men are abusive for watching it and toxic for watching it and women are being trafficked and abused for being in it, et cetera, et cetera. Usually when you show me a woman like that, I'll show you a woman who hasn't watched a whole lot of porn. You know what I mean? Women who are against porn typically aren't experts in the content of porn, as it turns out, because, you know, it disgusts them. So they're not consuming a whole lot of it, apparently. So women like that tend to believe that almost all porn is abusing women and beating them up and their mascara running, like I said, and forced deep throating. And yet when you go to the tube sites, like you mentioned earlier in this show, all their statistics are actually public. You know, you can research what the most popular videos are, what the most popular genres are, who the most popular downloaded, highest rated porn stars are. And you'll find that the most popular stuff out there really isn't all that evil. It's two people having hard sex or the girl giving him a sexy blowjob or something that's not really depraved and criminal and not really harming or abusing women, but just really hot chicks having sex with guys.
Let me tell you what made me very sympathetic to the women's perspective on porn, which was,
sure,
we looked at a lot of gay porn for our research too. Now, I'm a straight guy and I had never seen any gay porn or gay sexual acts until I started this research. And I remember the first times I was watching gay porn videos, my reaction was like, it's so explicit. And, oh, that's awful. How can they do this to each other? And like, come on, this is terrible. Like, I had that reaction. It was like, I don't want to see this. This is abusive. This is terrible. They're not, you know, like, how can this happen? Like, I had the words and emotions that came to my mind. Like, you know, afterwards, I was like, oh my gosh, this is exactly how women talk about, you know, male porn. So I think a piece of it too is when you look at somebody else's porn, porn designed to arouse someone else, because it doesn't arouse you at all, you just have a negative feeling. You know, we ended up calling this OPP, other people's porn. It's, we're all very dismissive and derogatory and fearful of, you know, the things that arouse other people. But the things that arouse us, it just seems natural and normal. And we always tend to imagine that other healthy people like us like the same things as us. But if you like something different, well, there must be somewhere in there something wrong with you.
That's a fascinating insight. I mean, yeah, there you are taking one for the team, you know, because you're having to watch this stuff in the name of research that you just really don't want to watch. And so, yeah, that's gross. That's offensive because it just offends your very sexual orientation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to see, you know, guys' penis in another guy's ass. You know, just I'm not wired to enjoy that. And so when I see it, I have an irrational resistance to it. You know, like just this is gross. This is, you know, offensive. This is wrong. And I have to imagine that, you know, for women watching graphic porn, that's not to their own taste. And we know women have very different tastes than men. So most porn that appeals to men is not going to appeal to women. And I think a lot of it's just this deeply natural, completely understandable reaction to other people's porn. We've seen this again and again, no matter what group we talk to. For example, people that like bestiality. So we talked to some fans of bestiality. We talked to webmasters of bestiality sites. Now, most people have very negative feelings towards bestiality, you know, think it's wrong, you know, it's, you know, beyond the pale, that sort of thing. You talk to these people, of course, they think it's natural and they don't feel so hung up on it, but they will condemn other kinds of pornography. You know, like they go out of their way to like insult, like incest porn, you know, even though incest porn's not really actual family members, most of it's, you know, dramatized and most of it's fiction. Like they would condemn incest porn as being far more negative for society than bestiality. So just whatever we're interested in just feels quite naturally, it feels like the right thing. And everybody else's interest, if we're not interested, it feels like the wrong thing. This informs so much of the dynamics surrounding pornography, I think.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that comes to mind is I read an article. Oh, it's probably been a couple years now about how certain porn producers are starting to encourage the homosexual agenda on heterosexuals. In other words, you know, you really should try sex with a transsexual, or you probably shouldn't, you know, completely pass off being gay until you've tried it, which to my sensibilities isn't really very fair because the homosexual groups for years have been preaching science, nature versus nurture. In other words, I didn't choose to be homosexual, so please don't try to re-educate me or whatever. However, now that homosexuality is more mainstream in our society, it seems like homosexual folks are saying, hey, you know what? All you straight people should try this. And so what's happened is certain porn producers are starting to sneak in two guys giving it to each other, or sneaking in transsexuals in what was advertised as heterosexual porn. And what's happening is guys are collectively cringing when it appears on the screen, like, oh man, you tricked me. I didn't want to see that. And yet they're thinking this is going to further the agenda. And the whole point of the article was that it's kind of backfiring. So it's probably going to be a flash in the pan. And I don't know if that was the case or not, but in your experience, did you see that that's going on at all?
Especially among men, we like what we like. So you're going to know if you're gay or not very early on. And being exposed to more gay material is not going to have any effect on that. There has to already be some basis for a sexual interest. You know, so if you're interested in, say, domination, there might be some clever or original genre of domination that will appeal to you. That might feel surprising, but it's, you know, it's based on the idea of domination. Like, let's say hypnosis porn, which is a somewhat popular subgenre where, you know, a man hypnotizes a woman and then gets her to, you know, perform sexual acts on him. So if you've never seen that before and you might see it for the first time and be like, oh my God, I had no idea this turned me on so much. But really it's playing with interest that was always there, that was domination. In contrast, you know, if you're attracted to women versus men, you know, that's there's no ambiguity there. You know, you know what you like, and it's not going to change just because you're exposed to more of it. I mean, it goes the other way too. Of course, there was a long period of time when there was conversion therapists that tried to turn gay people straight, and one of the things they did was show them lots and lots of straight porn, and it had no effect because, you know, you like what you like. Just being exposed to other stuff is not going to change that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. The whole science, everything you did with this book is utterly fascinating. And it just seems like quite literally, and you know, pun intended, nobody else had the balls to do it. It just took a lot of work. It was a lot of heavy lifting. And you're the guy who finally said, okay, I'll put my name beside this research and look at the value it has. It's amazing.
When we were first preparing to do this, before we actually embarked on it, we talked to a lot of our colleagues in the neurosciences. And 100% of them said, do not do this. They said, first, it would kill our careers. And second, we're not going to find much anyway, you know, sort of cognitive dissonance, you know,
as scientists,
if they're going to tell us not to do it, there must not be anything there. But not a single person in our field was the least bit encouraging of exploring this stuff. They all thought it was a dead end and there'd be nothing to find.
As if the entire universe doesn't revolve around sex.
Yeah, right.
There's nothing there. Nothing to see here, folks. Move on. Yeah. Crazy, crazy. You know, when you were doing your research and figuring out what people were watching, you were talking about bestiality. What is the real prevalence of people watching illegal porn? You know, where someone really is getting injured or people really are being trafficked and it's advertised as such, or dare I say, even underage children in porn. How many people are really seeking that out and watching it? Because, you know, in our minds, we're hoping it's just an infinitesimal minority of people, but I'm ready to hear the truth if you're ready to tell it.
So first, we did not and could not seek out illegal porn for obvious reasons. We don't want, you know, any illegal porn in our web traffic because we don't want the FBI showing up at our door. So we certainly did not try to analyze any illegal porn or illegal porn sites directly. However, we can look at searches for things like granny porn, incest porn, bestiality porn. And the truth is, it's very uncommon. Now, it exists. I don't have the stats in front of me, so take this with a grain of salt. It's going to be off by a few percentages. But I believe the total number of searches for bestiality is under 1% of all sexual searches. I think that's true. I'd have to pull up a data. Maybe after the show, I can go back and verify that. But it's extremely low. And incest porn searches, also fairly low.
Not to be confused with stepsister, stepmom porn.
No.
Astronomical.
Yeah, of course. Pedophilia, that is its own shadow empire. You know, that's all in the dark net. Hard to access that stuff. There's not that many searches for it, but we're pretty sure that's because people are smart enough to know that if they start searching for that in Google, you know, FBI is going to show up at their door eventually. So we know that there's a lot of people involved in this kind of shadow net exchanging child pornography stuff. But that's just, we don't have any good data on that and didn't try to get good data on that.
Well, I'm not sure whether that's encouraging or discouraging.
Yeah.
For the most part, you would say that there's this kind of weird relationship between what is normal and how different it is from what's accepted by society as normal. In other words, what we do in private has a certain pattern to it, kind of across the board, compared to how we all behave in public, which also has a completely different pattern.
That's right. I mean, we found a lot of big surprises in terms of the popularity. One of the biggest surprises actually was straight men's interest in transsexual porn. So it's usually called shemale porn, very derogatory term. So please don't go using that term.
Yeah, porn doesn't tend to be politically correct.
Exactly. If you're going online and searching for it in the genre, it's called shemale porn. Very, very popular among straight men internationally at much higher numbers than anybody expected. So that's a good example of something that in our normal everyday discourse, you know, very few straight men are going to admit an interest in that. And there's certainly, we don't see, you know, Hollywood movies don't tend to suggest that that's a secret interest. You know, that was something that was completely surprising to both cultural critics and to scientists. But it just shows there's things that turn us on in private that we just don't talk about at all.
Yeah. And woman on woman porn, aka lesbian porn, is incredibly popular amongst women who are living straight lives also, right?
That's right. Also, Stories about two straight men having sex. How do two straight men have sex? Well, that is a good question. But straight women love reading stories about two straight men having sex. It's called slash fiction in the fan fiction world, though it's also now plenty of romance novels about it. Like Brokeback Mountain. Brokeback Mountain, written by a woman. And the biggest audience for that movie was not gay men, it was women, because it's not really a gay story. It's sort of like a fantasy for women. So a perfect example of that, extremely popular among straight women.
How does it get its name, slash porn? That sounds like violence. That
it
sounds like
certainly does.
Wielding.
It actually refers to the punctuation mark, a backslash, because you slash two characters together. So for a long time, it was sort of amateur female writers writing this stuff. But that kind of storytelling just doesn't appeal to gay men any more than it appeals to straight men.
So we're talking a lot here about women's relationship to porn. And I think for most of the guys listening, what pops into our minds first is we're in a relationship with a woman who, if she ever caught us watching porn, the relationship would be over. We would be cheaters. She would be hauling us off to porn addiction meetings, if not just dumping us right there on the spot. Yet most guys are waiting for their wives or girlfriends to leave the house. And as soon as the headlights are gone from the end of the street, he's on the porn channel.
I think so much of the woman's reaction depends on what the porn is. You know, if it's straight porn and the actresses resemble the girlfriend or the wife, that's usually not the worst thing. I'm not saying it's good, but you know,
would that be better or worse that he's actually looking at actresses who look like the wife? I mean, it's like, well, why don't you just have sex with me then? I mean, really?
From what we've seen, that's much preferable to, like, here's a common situation. A guy is, his girlfriend is, say, a white, busty girlfriend, and she finds him looking at porn at flat-chested Asian women. This has happened a lot. That particular scenario, we've come across dozens of times. And that's much worse, because then the woman's thinking, oh, he's actually sexually aroused by something entirely different from me. So secretly, he's never been sexually aroused by me. He's got this sexual world that has nothing to do with me. If the women at least look like, you know, the girlfriend, at least it's like, okay, I know he's straight and he likes me, this kind of thing. Yeah, there's always the dynamics of cheating that go into porn discovery, but it's way worse because, you know, another example, we're just talking about shemale porn. A woman finds a man like looking at shemale porn or something like that that's very unorthodox, unconventional. That can cause terrible problems too. Very hard to explain, you know, to a woman, you know, what's going on with something like that. So, yeah, the content really drives the woman's reaction in those cases. If you're looking at just plain generic, you know, Playboy style porn, you know, women's not going to be happy. But, you know, I think most of the time with a good conversation, you'll be able to talk through it. Yeah, I don't know how you resolve it when if your wife catches you watching shemale porn.
I'll tell you, it really just comes down to men wanting variety. I mean, every guy listening to this show understands that. Hey, if I'm married to a busty blonde woman, you know, I'm kind of in the mood for a little, you know, waifish brunette because yeah, right. She's different. Exactly. She's something I don't have every day. I can understand that. Other guys can understand that, but I can also fully grasp how women would freak out over that.
Yeah.
So what about women and their relationship to porn? What are they watching? How many women really are watching porn? Because on one hand, you're thinking, okay, women can't stand porn. They're all against it. Kind of like all women want a relationship and none of them don't. You know, we have these stereotypes about how women are, especially in terms of their view of relationships, et cetera. But you're also hearing in the media that porn usage is way up amongst women. And, you know, some of them are watching girl on girl porn. Some of them are watching woman-friendly porn. But like you said, a lot of these women are also watching dirty, horny, Nancy Friday-ish kind of stuff out there. How many women really are, dare I say, friendlier towards porn nowadays?
Most women do not watch porn and do not like porn and are not aroused by porn. So most women prefer a narrative. They prefer something psychological. They prefer characters and personalities and conversations and interactions. And that tends to work better in text. That's why the romance novel is the iconic example of women's erotica. You know, it's 300 pages of, you know, storytelling of lots of talking and wondering and getting to know each other, you know, interspersed with some steamy sex scenes. A man is not going to sit through 300 pages, to get off. It's just not going to happen. But there is a minority of women who do enjoy visual porn. It's hard to get good numbers on this because it's much harder to get insight into women's activity than men's activity. But it's somewhere between 15% and 35% of women do enjoy pornography. We found in our research some suggestive findings. We did find that women who prefer visual porn also tended to have male stereotypical patterns of behavior. They were more likely to be risk-taking. They were more likely to be thrill-seekers, more likely to enjoy being dominant in their relationship. So things that we typically associate with male behaviors were correlated with women who preferred visual porn. But it's important to underscore that with the fact that over the years, there have been several attempts to create magazines or websites that featured visual porn for women. Playgirl is the first and most famous, or maybe the most notorious example. Of course, Playgirl came out, and what was the biggest audience for Playgirl? It wasn't straight women. It was gay men. You know, and eventually, I think about 10 years ago, finally, like, it was the great pretense. The editors of Playgirl kept pretending that the audience was women. And then 10 years, they finally gave up. It's clearly targeting gay men. When we did our research, there was literally thousands of pay sites trying to make money off of selling porn to men. And there was exactly 3 successful sites selling visual porn to women. And I think 2 of them have gone out of business since we did our research. So it's very hard to make money or have a business creating visual pornography for women, you know. And another reason too is those women, the minority of women that do like visual porn, they're perfectly content with the porn that appeals to men. You know, they'll just go to Pornhub to get the kind of porn they want. So the women that have more stereotypical female interests, they tend to gravitate towards romance novels and stories. So it's just, there's not really a market for female-friendly porn, so to speak, for porn that's designed by women, for women. There's not an audience.
I think another very surprising element of porn to women is the range of body types and types of women in general that men actually are attracted to. Because, of course, the media stereotype is beautiful women are long, leggy, supermodel, skinny women with angular features and a certain color hair. And you look up the most searched, most appreciated, highest ranked porn actresses over the course of time, and they often don't look like that at all. They're rather large women. They may be 5'5", 160 or 170 pounds with, as I term it, lots of toys to play with. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I think that comes as a shock to a lot of women when they really find out who these women are that we as men are so attracted to. They're not necessarily women we would consider to be, arm candy.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about our taste in terms of physical body types and the kind of women we're attracted to.
As you pointed out, there's tremendous divergence between what we see on magazine covers as ideal women and what men actually look for in their pornography. And you hit the biggest thing already, which is the weight. Magazine models tend to be skinny and thin, and women think that's the ideal that they should strive for because they're looking at the magazines, you know, because they're not looking at the pornography. But what we found in our research, one of the first findings that really shocked us because nobody had predicted it was the interest in heavy women. Heavy women, what we would consider significantly overweight by the standards of the Center for Disease Control.
Almost all of us are by those standards.
Yes, that's right. But very popular. We found many more men searching for heavy or fat or big women than searching for skinny or slender. Certainly definitely interest in slender women and definitely sexual searches for it. But many more searches for what's known as BBWs, you know, big, beautiful women. Very, very popular genre, one of the most popular genres. And I think a lot of women don't realize this and are shocked by it and don't know what to make of it because they're like, but how come those aren't on our magazines? I should add, though, that just in the past 5 years, society is changing. You've probably noticed this too, but you do see a lot more heavy women in TV ads, on magazine covers. So sort of our mainstream understanding of what's an attractive woman is changing a lot too. Right. Driven a lot by women, I think, but it is become more culturally acceptable. But it's also spilling over into men's taste. You know, you were talking about arm candy. I think it is a little more acceptable now for a man to be dating a heavier woman, not as embarrassing as it was. I don't think we've gone all the way, but certainly compared to it was, say, 20 years ago, I think things are moving in that direction. I think things are moving towards truth. Many men are aroused by women with a little meat on their bones, and I think that's starting to get reflected in society as well. Though it's the number of heavy women portrayed as ideals in society is nowhere near the number that we see in the world of porn.
Yeah. Nevertheless, you make a solid point. You have so-called plus-size models gracing the cover of Sports Illustrated now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of to wrap up here, I'd like to do a lightning round with you of other surprising findings from your research. Give us just a random sampling of some of the more interesting things you found out.
One of our favorite findings, this one's not terribly important in terms of understanding human sexuality, but we just thought this was fascinating, was we looked at the most popular animal to have sex with in different countries. And each country had its own popular animal. For example, Saudi Arabia, there was a lot of porn about camels. In England, it was the pony was the most popular animal. In Australia, it was sheep. You know, sheep very popular. Australia. In America, it's the dog. So you kind of see like the animal that's, you know, kind of represented the most in popular culture also tends to appear apparently in people's sexual fantasies. We thought that was interesting because in general, sexual tastes are pretty similar all around the world. Women are interested in erotic stories and the same kinds of fan fiction stories in Japan, in Brazil, in South Africa, in Kenya, in England. The tastes are all the same. There's not that much variability from culture to culture in terms of taste, but the animal that people preferred was one of them. Another thing, though, that was particularly interesting is granny porn. So this is being interested in looking at erotica with older women, you know, women old enough to be a grandmother. Now, biologically speaking, you know, it doesn't make any sense to be sexually attracted to an old woman because obviously you can't reproduce with an old woman. So evolution has made it so men's sexual interests are very much oriented towards young, fertile women because that's, you know, how you produce children. So it's surprising that granny porn exists at all. But there was tremendous variety, cultural variety in that. For example, I remember Czechoslovakia, England, and Kenya all had strong interest in granny porn. And there were other countries where like it didn't exist at all. And so that was an example where there was always a very specific cultural reason. So for example, in Kenya, I remember it's because teenagers learn about sex, not from their parents, but from their grandparents. So a grandmother might explain sexuality. They don't have sex, but you know, you're learning about sex from sitting down with your grandmother. So that must be one of the reasons. In Czechoslovakia, Czechoslovakia has a very liberal sex industry. It's much easier to be a prostitute in Czechoslovakia. They have areas where there's prostitutes. And there's a lot of older women who work as prostitutes in Czechoslovakia. So that perhaps that's the reason why it's more popular there than elsewhere. In England, we were told, don't know if this is true, but you know, we asked different porn site webmasters in England about why they thought granny porn was so popular there. And the common response we always got on that was, there's a lot of school marms. So you have school teachers and they had corporal punishment apparently in England till relatively recently. So you'd have, you know, older women spanking you or slapping your wrists or hitting you. And so for, you know, young boys, that might be their first contact with women. So there's a lot of fantasies about that that seem to be informing it. So not much cultural variety in general, but I remember bestiality and granny porn was one where there was a lot of culture to culture variation.
Yeah, so in the case of granny porn, it comes back down to the viewer being reminded of someone.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Fascinating stuff, Ogie. And I want to point these guys to your book. I've added A Billion Wicked Thoughts to my Amazon influencer page, along with a couple other interesting books by Ogie that we're going to have him back on real soon to discuss. One of them is called Dark Horse, which has a fascinating subject, which is why certain people who don't necessarily fit the mold of success patterns end up being successful anyway. And it's really a great book. I'm going to add A Billion Wicked Thoughts and Dark Horse to my Amazon influencer page, where you can also find other books by other folks who have been guests on this show. And I will also point you to www.mountaintoppodcast.com/Ogie, which is O-G-I, where you will get a direct link to A Billion Wicked Thoughts, where you can purchase it on Amazon.com. Ogie Ogis, what a great conversation. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. And this has been, you know, one of the more entertaining episodes we've had in a long time. And I'm sure the guys loved it. Thank you so much.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And we'll have you on again real soon to talk about Dark Horse too.
Sounds great.
And guys, if you have not visited www.mountaintoppodcast.com, I can assure you, first of all, it is 100% safe for work. Okay. Contrary to everything we've been talking about here on this show, you'll find that, you know, Mountaintop Podcast is a pretty tame, you know, user friendly, viewer friendly, employment friendly website. So you can go there and find out not only more about our guests, but you can get on my daily mailing list where I'll give you actionable advice so you can get better with the kind of women you'd love to have in your life. You can also download free reports and talk to me free for 25 minutes by hitting the little red button in the upper right corner on the site and scheduling that. And I'm exactly the guy you think I'm going to be. I'm who I am on this show in real life. And you can look forward to a great conversation where we'll talk about what's going on in your life and how to get you the success you want. It's all there for you at www.mountaintoppodcast.com. www.mountaintoppodcast.com. And until I talk to you again real soon, this is Scott McKay from XMY Communications in San Antonio, Texas. Be good out there.
The Mountaintop Podcast is produced by XMY Communications. All rights reserved worldwide. Be sure to visit www.mountaintoppodcast.com for show notes. And while you're there, sign up for the free XMY Communications newsletter for men. This is Ed Roy Odom speaking for the Mountaintop Podcast.